Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Today, we spend the hour with Professor John Michaels of the University of California, Los Angeles, exploring the latest nominee for Supreme Court Justice, the possible role for the four so-called liberal justices, and how privatization has amounted to what Michaels calls a constitutional coup. Welcome, John Michaels. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. Perhaps a good start would be this latest Supreme Court pick, Brett Kavanaugh. I've read both Fear and Praise, and some of the praise actually came from a leftist saying, well, you know, he reads the scholarship. He's open-minded. What do we know?
So one way to think about this is whether we're considering Brett Kavanaugh as a one-off judge or if we're thinking about the total composition of the court and whether it reflects where we are as a society, not just in terms of democratic politics, but in terms of elections and kind of median interest and commitments to such, you know, hot button issues as voting rights, executive power, abortion. And so I agree with a lot of the praise that this is a very accomplished, very distinguished, by all accounts, incredibly bright jurist. The real question for me, though, is what does it mean to have a five-member conservative wing of the court that lacks a real kind of moderate, as we had with Justice Kennedy? And so thinking about Kavanaugh as a replacement for Kennedy, as opposed to thinking about Kavanaugh himself, I think is a critical kind of a perspective to bring to the table. So not taking anything necessarily away from Kavanaugh, but thinking about whether this is the right type of jurist on the court at this particular time, given our politics.
So if you were going to assess expectations about him, would you put him in the category of, say, the Scalia wing, or would you put him separately? The argument I read was that he's a little more well-read than Scalia. He's a little more thoughtful than Scalia, but politically he might be aligned. What would you think?
I don't fully I think you're referencing a New York Times op-ed by Keel Amar, who made a very forceful case for us, the nation, giving Kavanaugh essentially our support. I don't know whether whether someone being well-read and intellectual is sufficient at this point. I feel like that is a baseline qualification, and anyone, regardless of where he or she fits into the ideological spectrum, we would expect that from. So for me, the reasons why I have an understanding or an expectation that Kavanaugh is going to align pretty hard to the right is because the conservative movement, the conservative legal community, has been outstandingly successful in vetting candidates and being super careful that whomever is brought before the president has already passed essentially any number of litmus tests. And the kind of long-term mantra has been, we don't want another suitor, who's my old boss, who I think disappointed a lot of folks on the conservative side of the political spectrum for being a true moderate. Now, of course, it's very different at the time. George H.W. Bush was not the same type of Republican that we see kind of, you know, dominating the kind of political discourse today. So it may not even, it may not have been such a huge surprise to the George W. H.W. Bush wing of the party that that Souter, you know, kind of his jurisprudence was quite centrist. But that certainly is out of touch with today's Republican Party. And I believe he's been well vetted. And for that reason, I think he's going to slot himself quite far on the right.
What do you know about that vetting process? It sounds like there's a full machine going on with, like, the Federalist Society and others. What goes on?
So I've never been vetted by the Federalist Society, not surprisingly, but my sense is that the Federalist Society has been quite successful and I think deserves a lot of credit for developing and nurturing young legal talent that has an inclination to lean in the conservative direction and to provide all sorts of resources and support to allow them to flourish in their careers and put them in a good position to be able to serve in positions of public service. And to be clear, I think it's important that conservatives serve in public service. It's just that we lack a certain type of now balance in the court because the country isn't an overarchingly conservative country. It's really a centrist country. And it just happens to be that most of the Supreme Court appointments have landed on Republicans' watch. But that's the vagaries of life tenure and when people age and when people kind of, you know, call it a career.
And when we did have a vacancy by a death, of course, we had a Senate Majority Leader pulling his weight and blocking an appointment by Barack Obama.
Right. And so you're referencing, of course, and that's, you know, again, of critical significance, Mitch McConnell's right. Unprecedented move, essentially, to keep Merrick Garland from getting a vote. And by the way, all the praise that's been lavished on Kavanaugh and been lavished right beforehand on Neil Gorsuch for his distinguished record as a jurist, as a leading member of the bar, as a kind of scholar jurist, applies to the same extent to Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland had a distinguished public service career, distinguished private sector career. He's been a judge for a very long time. He's written leading articles on antitrust, things that are not, you know, hot button, you know, Roe v. Wade type of issues. And he didn't get a shake. He didn't get a fair shake. And the court would obviously look very differently. And this one, though, feels different for because Gorsuch replacing Scalia is essentially a one-to-one replacement, whereas Kavanaugh replacing Kennedy moves the court to the right.
Right. And you actually used the term in your Los Angeles Times opinion piece, arch conservative. And you also just now mentioned a few issues, voting rights, you know, presidential power. What exactly does it mean to be an arch conservative in the issues?
So I would say Kennedy is a conservative centrist. So just to be clear about kind of where we're thinking about the lines, I would think that and some of the, you know, older or former justices who were kind of right leaning were more just conservative, not arch conservative in terms of the degree to which their kind of methodologies are consistently originalist. And for those who don't know about originalism, it's trying to interpret the Constitution based on the framers' original meaning, as opposed to thinking about the Constitution as a living document that evolves over time and matches and kind of grows with the various twists and turns that our nation takes politically, economically, demographically. So when I say arch conservative, in some ways it's to try to engender or to recognize that there's space exists between a Justice Anthony Kennedy, who I do think is a conservative, who happens to play the role of centrist on this court, and I think, you know, to some extent has done that with some degree of success, or a conservative like a Sandra Day O'Connor. Those are conservatives that it seems like the Republican Party is drifting away from. I don't know where, you know, Justice O'Connor would kind of, you know, place herself on a political map now or ever, but it seems as if that's a different tradition. The more of a George H.W. Bush tradition of the Republican Party, the, you know, Rockefeller Republican sort, that's rapidly fading from the American landscape in law and politics.
Now, you have been among quite a few professors, law professors particularly, who have put forward a public letter that dealt with President Donald Trump, the Mueller investigation, and suggesting that even the idea of him being able to fire this man is really not aligned with the principles of the Constitution. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of this letter and what are the legal issues around this?
I think there's a longstanding concern that the president will not allow the independent investigation that's being led by Robert Mueller go forward to the point in which there's some kind of satisfactory conclusion, whether that means a recommendation for prosecution or something else. And I think one of the motivations behind letters of this sort is to try to stay on top and get out in front on occasion of what I think is reasonable to at least anticipate is the possibility that this investigation will be short-circuited and be short-circuited for reasons of a cover-up, as it were, to obstruct an investigation that seems to be finding true wrongdoing. And I think the concerns are simply one of them is you see that plays out not necessarily in legal corridors. And these questions may never ultimately be decided by a court of law, and these may ultimately be kind of political considerations, but the constant refrains of trying to delegitimize the investigation, not because it's independent, but quite the contrary, because they keep on saying that the White House and the White House surrogates keep on saying that the Mueller team is partial. They're a bunch of Hillary lovers, and that they're not giving the president a fair shake. Robert Mueller we're talking about Kavanaugh's credentials or Merrick Garland's credentials. Robert Mueller is another one of these people who has an unimpeachable record of public service across kind of different political lines, different lines of ideology. Robert Mueller is a true professional, and the folks he's surrounding himself with presumably match meet his high standards. And the concern is this will get shut down because Mueller is finding too much. This feels a little different from some of the concerns that in the abstract might make us think, oh, these independent investigations are a problem because they're hamstringing the president's agenda. It doesn't seem like that's what's motivating this. It doesn't seem as if the president is in any ways encumbered from, for instance, as he's doing, you know, imminently, meeting with Vladimir Putin. It's not as if it's, you know, they're not making the argument that this is constraining the president to carry out his, you know, Article II responsibilities. It seems like they're trying to short circuit it because
there's something there.
Well, there's something there, and purely on the ad hominem attacks, mm-hmm. that this is a partisan investigation. So sorry, and this is a long winded way of kind of background to the underlying point, which is the president's interference with an investigation is presumptively an untoward act because it's not in keeping with his responsibilities to faithfully take care that the laws are executed in this country. It seems to be based on concerns that the investigation is actually finding matters that are disconcerting. And we wanted to be clear here to separate out kind of good faith actions that the president has plenty of room to maneuver under Article II with those that we would classify as outside of the scope of the president's power. And the president is trying to undermine an investigation that is not consistent with the broad powers that the president enjoys. Again, whether that's going to be litigated, because that's hard to prove motive, I have my suspicions. But we need to be aware of what the president is doing, because even if the investigation does get shut down at a point, what does that mean for impeachment? What does that mean for the American public sending other signals through, say, midterm elections and whatnot? So to keep the kind of understanding that the president doesn't have unfettered power, the president is a constitutional actor. And that helps him in some cases and gives him broad discretion, but also really cabins him when he's going to act outside the scope of his authority.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with UCLA law professor John Michaels about the future of the Supreme Court, given Donald Trump's new appointment.
Suppose it did happen. Let's just look at this sort of...
That Mueller gets fired.
Yeah. And suppose that he does manage to do that or discredit him just in the report just to such an extent that it holds no weight. What are the worst case scenarios there?
Well, the worst case scenario, you know, it's hard to say what the worst case scenario is in different dimensions. But I think if the Mueller report is either shut down or it's successfully discredited, I think that creates a further confusion and kind of despair and anger among the population about what can we believe and what can't we believe. Like, does it bring into disrepute the entire FBI, as it seems to be sometimes the attacks seem to be even broader than the Mueller team? So I'm worried in terms of our political culture that the country is working off of two different scripts. And folks like me are willing to give professionals like Robert Mueller the benefit of the doubt, and those who think that Mueller is completely untrustworthy and irresponsible. So I worry about the constant discrediting and delegitimation of Mueller, federal judges that kind of rule against the president when the president takes measures that the courts deem outside of the scope of, again, either constitutional or statutory authority, the systemic discrediting of the press. And if the press kind of circles the wagons around Mueller, as they probably would, most of it would. So I worry about those issues. Whether there'd be a constitutional standoff is the other dimension. So those are the kind of like, what about the political legal culture questions, and then whether there'd be a standoff. Now, in a time in which government functions well and the separation of powers that we have, that we've had since the founding, works well, and Congress has to kind of take seriously its independent role, that could roll straight into considerations of impeachment. So that would be the kind of natural next step. That step may not go anywhere, depending on the composition of the Congress, the House, and the Senate at that particular moment. But I think shutting down an investigation would be additional grounds, let's put it that way, additional grounds for impeachment.
Would it throw the country into a sort of crisis, a constitutional crisis? Would it be saying something about the rule of law and what has happened to the United States in terms of, I mean, the last time we dealt with something like this was Nixon, right? And at least Nixon stepped down. And now we have something that's kind of going way beyond the pale. It looks like a crisis even before a crisis, at least in some ways.
Yeah, so I was, in some ways, the fact that we're having these conversations and seriously entertaining the existence of a crisis means we're at least at the precipice of something, however we want to classify it, okay? So I agree with that. The other thing that makes – so there's a number of things that distinguishes this from the Nixon precedent. Nixon was obviously, let's say, ethically challenged in a number of ways, and clearly it seems as if laws were broken and responsibilities, or the implication was they went, the wrongdoing reached the White House. But Nixon was a professional in the way that I don't think our current president is. And I think he cared about his legacy. And I think that shaped both his decision to resign and also what he did post his career afterwards, his efforts, whether successful or not, whether absurd or not, to kind of rehabilitate himself, I think spoke to a sense in which he cared about the country and the institutions, even if he tried to, kind of cheat his way through it. The other thing that happened is the country turned on Nixon, and Republicans turned on Nixon. And I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Well,
this
we have
time
a
too.
Very divided country, and we have a very divided media here in the country. And I think that that's quite different from what we had in the Nixon era.
Yeah, so I agree. And so at that point, everyone was kind of working off of the same script. Now, not just because of the kind of professional media has kind of moved into different camps, as it were, the Fox News camp and the MSNBC News camp. But, everyone's a armchair journalist. And so people are drawing their own conclusions based on their social media communities are fueling their own kind of perspective on these issues. So we're not working off of, one or two scripts as was the case during the Nixon era. And then there's good to that and there's bad. At this point, it seems like it's dangerous because there are two sets of camps that are speaking very different languages when discussing the present and discussing whether we're in a kind of a golden era or a period of kind of perpetual crisis, as it were. So, I mean, I'm concerned. I'm very concerned. And I'm not sure we're it's hard to figure out when we're in a crisis. I mean, look what's going on with ICE. Look what's going on with NATO. We might not know we're in crisis until we're three quarters of the way through it. So the answer is yes. But whether a termination of Mueller, the firing of Rod Rosenstein in order to get to Mueller, whether that would be the kind of tipping point, I don't know. Because the country seems to have a pretty deep reservoir of taking a lot of handling a lot of really really dangerous and destructive conversations and policies that have been going on since January 20th, 2017. So we clearly are, and I think that speaks to a lot of the importance of the values and the laws and all these professionals that we're talking about that can keep this country largely together, even though we're being run in a seemingly reckless dimension. I would say one thing about that, though, if I may, because you referenced the New York Times op-eds, and I'd like to give also credit to another law professor, another colleague down the road from me at Irvine, who authored an op-ed today in the New York Times, basically calling out those who say, Kavanaugh, you know, he's a pro, it'll be fine, the courts aren't that important. And she basically says that's true for a large segment of the kind of talking class, as it were, those with privilege, those with access to those with the ability to essentially insulate themselves from, let's say, arbitrary or abusive government action. And that's not everyone, and that's not necessarily the people we want the court to be most worried about. We want the courts. Historically, the courts have been the last line of defense when the political branches basically turn a blind eye.
Well, in some eras, let's not give them too much credit, but in the last few decades, perhaps.
Yes, I think that's right. But I would say, you know, basically, I think of in some ways our modern society only started with the New Deal, because that's when, you know, voting was extended and that's when civil rights started happening. We truly came an inclusive polity. And in that period of time, the courts have been, not always, but certainly in some ways more reliably than the political branches in terms of protecting those who are disempowered.
Well, that could be part of the motivation, if in fact you're right. And I know there's some arguments on the other side of that.
Of course, yeah.
The hollow hope and all of that.
Of course.
But say that you are right, that the courts have been sort of the, you know, backbone for protecting rights. That could be very well why the courts have become so important to the, what you called the arch conservatives. Now, let's talk about that for a second. You clearly have some optimism. Because in that piece that you wrote in the LA Times, you've sent a message out, particularly to liberal justices, saying it's time to be strident. It's time to be the great dissenter. It's time to be willing to be the lone dissenter, like Rehnquist had done. So clearly you think that not all hope is lost.
Yeah, I think it's a long-term play. But just on this point, whether we agree or disagree on how central the court has been to vindicating rights is that's an interesting side conversation. But either way, I think we would both agree that the courts play a role. And so whether they played the primary role or secondary role, either way, the courts matter. So I know there were a couple of other points that you raised. One is, you know, is this one of the reasons why the conservatives have focused on the court? And I think the answer is yes. I think the conservatives feel, rightly or wrongly, that the courts have been the leader in the expansion and recognition of rights for those who have been marginalized in society. If you look at race, if you look at gender, and if you look at, especially now, LGBTQ questions, you're right. The legislatures, particularly some state legislatures, have been quite advanced on these issues, others not so much. But clearly the courts have become the final word one way or the other. And so I don't know why. Let's say the progressives or liberals or left liberals or however you want to classify the opposite side haven't been as attentive to it. Part of it is simply precedents. For whatever reason, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton did not go to the mat for liberal justices or appellate judges either. So that's part of the story is very idiosyncratic on that front. But to the larger point, do I have hope for the future? I do, because the country, I do think the country is strong. In part, it's strong because of all the things that are being derided and yet still showing up to work the next day. And here I'll put professional members of the press. I will put bureaucrats, whether the folks who work at the EPA, the folks who work at the Department of Interior. It is not necessarily a fun place to work these days, but they're doing their job. Now, it does raise interesting questions. We could kind of bracket ICE right now because that's law enforcement feels a little different. But the country stays together in part because we have this rich history, even if it's a spotty history in terms of who we've kind of empowered and who we've left to the side, of taking seriously questions of law and cohesion and things like that. So I do think ultimately the long-term play is to revitalize a left liberal jurisprudence. And one of the ways to do that is by jurists, whether they're, you know, ideally at the Supreme Court, but also courts of appeals, also state court judges, to take bold stances. And the reason in the op-ed that I say now's the time to do it is in part because they don't have to, the justices don't have to kind of moderate their positions in order to satisfy or try to win over the centrist Justice Kennedy. They're not going to win over. The new median justice, by all accounts, is going to be John Roberts. John Roberts is not going to swing. If John Roberts swings to the, with the liberals, he's probably is probably going to take a sixth member to do it, like in the Affordable Health Care case. We're not going to see it from Justice Roberts. He's not in play, and that frees up the progressive jurist to make a strong case for developing a jurisprudence that over time can capture more attention and more kind of public resonance than it currently has.
So back in 2017. You wrote a piece referencing the deep state, and you talked about the origins of the concept and where it was important and how it wasn't so important here in the United States. Can you give us some background, given how prominent that phrase is in conservative media and in conservative dialogue today? Talk about the origins of that and why you say it doesn't apply to the U.S.
Yeah, so this kind of came out of nowhere for me. So I'm among the my scholarly pursuits, I study the professional civil service and what it means to our country, and the type of work that, as I was kind of referencing before, with you know the line agents at the Department of Interior and Department of and the EPA, and all of a sudden I see these comments about a deep state. Now, one of my other hats that I wear scholarly is I do national security law, so I know a little bit about countries like Pakistan and Egypt and Turkey, where that term has had much more resonance in academic circles. Okay, and in those circles, it's about kind of entrenched groups of elites who dictate essentially government policy, irrespective of the kind of the legislature or the plebiscites or anything else. Often they control the levers of the media, often they control the military, often they control the courts, et cetera, et cetera. It's a term that's used in very much a pejorative context. And now all of a sudden they're referencing American bureaucrats that way. And this is like just ratcheting up the discourse, ratcheting up the kind of nasty rhetoric from, bureaucrats have been essentially assailed in this country, you know, maybe forever because there's this anti-intellectual, kind of flavor to the country. But certainly in the 80s, when Ronald Reagan really started hammering at bureaucrats and saying the worst words in the American language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, the most terrifying words. Right? So we've had having this kind of slow burn of challenging bureaucrats. And then draining the swamp became the discourse during the election, that they're swamp creatures, they're swamp monsters, and they're not real Americans. Then we ratchet it up even higher to this issue of the deep state, and that somehow these civil servants are controlling the government and in some kind of orchestrated fashion. It feeds into the anti-Mueller stuff. It feeds into anti-climate change. It feeds into anti-civil rights. Anything you could possibly think of, it's kind of a label that sticks and makes people uncomfortable. So here's why I think it's complete bunk, for instance, okay? The American Civil Service doesn't have this type of power. In fact, our civil service is relatively weak compared to, forget about those other countries, the kind of, somewhat tyrannical countries or democratic countries, but certainly compared to continental Europe as well. Political leadership on top of agencies is very influential, as you see when you see, you know, how Ryan Zinke or Scott Pruitt is basic, or Betsy DeVoe is essentially halting the levers of government in those, you know, critical agencies. And the courts play such a big role in administrative action. So if a civil servant went rogue, there's so many layers of oversight that would chop that guy or that woman's legs off. They would never get anywhere. And so I was very offended by this. As someone who thinks actually our civil service is gets a bad rap and doesn't have as much support and protection as it should have because it plays a meaningful role, to then say they're un-American, they're disloyal, they're part of some kind of siege really kind of got under my skin. And that's how sometimes scholarship works. It certainly seems to be working that way in the era of Donald Trump. And so I wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs essentially saying that that deep states don't look anything like what they look like in those countries. And by the way, if we think about depth and bureaucratic depth, shouldn't that be a good thing? Shouldn't that be a reason to celebrate that even if we have a couple of cranky actors or a couple of dangerous actors, the whole of the community will keep the government running well? So for me, I've also tried to essentially say that, yes, we should distinguish the deep state from Pakistan or Turkey, but we should also be okay with depth. We don't want a superficial government. We don't want a government by hacks who come in and think they know what they're doing.
When we come back, how does privatization amount to a constitutional coup? Stay tuned.
Fascism comes along when the rich people get the generals to help them stay in control.
Yeah.
It's in one little sentence, that's it. The rich people get the generals to help them stay in charge.
Singing. Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board. Do I see Lieutenant Calais? Do I see Captain Medina? Do I see General Coster and all his crew? Do I see President Nixon? Do I see both houses of Congress? Do I see the voters, me and you? Last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg. Last train.
Pete Seeger performing Last Train to Nuremberg include a conversation between Tim Robbins and Pete Seeger from July 2006.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Privatization of government services has been in place since Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, both who roundly attacked government and civil servants as the enemy. Now, however, the government has become in the service of those who once opposed it. The process has been part of what John Michaels calls a constitutional coup. John Michaels is a professor of law and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. Now, you have recently published a book, Constitutional Coup. Coup's a pretty powerful word.
It is. And in fairness, the title was conceived when well before the election of Donald Trump, when I would have put much money on Secretary of State Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. I had time to incorporate what it means for Donald Trump to be the president. But the book is really about the way in which the kind of commercialization of government, the outsourcing of key functions, privatization, all of those features of kind of modern neoliberal government, what you call running government like a business or whatever the kind of tropes are of the moment. And it's been bipartisan, again, since the 80s, essentially undermines essential rule of law values. It undercuts our separation of powers. And it becomes a tool of heightened executive power. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, I was concerned about that. I started these projects not only saying, you know, thinking Hillary Clinton was going to win. I started writing these projects in the late 2000 aughts when Barack Obama, president, I have great admiration and was happy to have President Obama lead the country. I was still concerned about these trends. These are trends that are bipartisan. Bill Clinton was a mover in running government like a business. And so the concerns there are really about how commercialization of government isn't just about fraud and abuse of the kind of fiscal sort, which is largely what we've talked about over the years, whether it's military contracting or prison contracting, but it actually undermines central safeguards of our constitutional republic. And that's why I call it a coup, because it completely transforms the way we do everything from welfare services to environmental law to fighting wars to criminal justice. And of course, this has taken on kind of almost cartoonish characteristics in the Trump era, where it seems like, you know, there's very little distance, as it were, between Trump organization, the business operation, and Trump presidency, whether it's, you know, the various Ivanka endeavors or Kushner's real estate deals or Trump talking about, you know, his winery when questions were asked about the kind of KKK rallies in Charlottesville, and his response was, I have, you know, vineyards there. So this has taken on almost cartoonish perspective. And even in the book, I have kind of an optimistic line, which is when we kind of see our way out of the current moment, it might be an opportunity. There might be kind of a bureaucratic renaissance where we realize that some of the folks who kept this country going were the bureaucrats, and we start investing more heavily in a professional civil service. I'm not sure when we get to that point, but that's, again, the kind of ultimate goal, because the civil service provides a very meaningful and powerful check on political agency heads that often represent 48% of the country.
But that's when people are interested in the truth. So, like, when.
Yes.
So that's a clear distinction between what we have now and what we may have had under previous presidents. I mean, to some degree. I recognize that there's degrees to all of this, that it's not black and white.
That is true, but my theory on why we need to have what I call in the book administrative separation of powers is because the concerns that I'm raising under Donald Trump's watch or under George W. Bush's watch are just as important under a Barack Obama's watch or whoever, an Elizabeth Warren. Because if you're really worried that a president who wins with, you know, a good win these days is 49-50% of the population, because we're so divided, and if some third candidate runs, that's why no one can get to 50. And all of a sudden, the levers of government shift from the right to the left, and all of a sudden our regulatory policy kind of flips on its head. That's disruptive to everyone. We don't have a parliamentary system where you get, okay, the conservative government's out, the Tory government's out, and now we're going to have a Labor government. Everything's going to change on a dime. We don't have that. And it's important. We don't. For one, it's not our culture. You know, it's not just, forget about our constitution. It's just not our culture to be like that. But secondly, we don't have a fail-safe for that, because if a Labor government takes the country too far, the government collapses.
Yeah,
we have to wait.
Yeah.
We have to wait sometimes 4 really long, hard years for another crack to change the president, and then therefore to change the direction of ICE or the direction of the Pentagon or anything else. And so my position really, I think, is a position that should appeal to those who believe that the center matters and the center holds. Even though I'm not a centrist politically, I think the center is key to our political culture and to our legal culture.
So let's shift just a bit into the argument that you're making about privatization harming the Constitution, the country. Now, it's clear that once you privatize something, that the democratic control is gone, because it's not transparent in the same way that government is supposed to be transparent. People don't really have a say over a private corporation in the way that they do over government that they collectively own. But what about this rule of law argument that you made just now? How does it undermine rule of law?
So privatization is a complicated issue. So one of the concerns principally about privatization is the government turns over some responsibility to the contractors, and the contractors just run with it. And that is a concern about abdication of government power. That is central, and that's well known. I'm also concerned about a second type of, let's say, reconfiguration of government power, and this is where the rule of law comes into play as well. A lot of times, the political leadership of the country, of the agencies, doesn't like the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is slow. The bureaucracy is obstinate. The bureaucracy is going to say, well, that doesn't really, I understand that's what the president campaigned on, but it's not really comports with the statutes that we're that empower us. It's not consistent with our appropriations. It's not consistent with our best scientific understanding. And there's a lot of frustration, a lot of stickiness. And I celebrate that friction because the friction between the political leadership of agencies and the civil servants in some ways reproduces the friction that we hope to exist between Congress and the president. A lot of friction is at the center of our sense of liberty, our sense of pluralism, because it allows more voices to have a say. It does slow things down. It's maddeningly frustrating. But in the 20th century, legislation, so Congress has taken a backseat to agencies. Rules promulgated by agencies become much more central. Think about, like, again, think about the environment. We're working off of statutes that are old. Food and Drug Administration. We're working off statutes that were progressive era statutes. Ever since then, Congress has kind of taken a back seat and the agencies run with it. So if you now have a political leadership that wants to push, let's say, an FDA agenda in a certain direction, let's say to make it really hard to get over-the-counter or even prescription birth control, as we've seen in various fights, it makes it really hard to do that. That doesn't necessarily match with the best science. You want the pushback. You want the friction. And the civil servants say, no, boss, I can't do that. That's not consistent with our statutory responsibilities to work through the best kind of scientific evidence. And it's not going to be reasonable. The courts are going to reject it. Goes on. Every president doesn't like the civil service. Obama, Clinton, Truman, Eisenhower, whomever. And privatization has now become a backdoor way to get around the civil servants because the contractors are yes men and women because the civil servants are tenured. You can say no to your boss and show up the next day and get your paycheck. A contractor who says no to the political leadership too much is going to wind up having his contract canceled. So they're going to be completely compliant. And I say the concern isn't runaway contractors as much as it's super compliant contractors because we lose that friction, that tension that really is at the core of our constitutional regime. So that's why I think it's a basic rule of law question. Once Congress has given the power to the agencies themselves have to be subject to checks and balances. And those checks and balances, as best conceived, is understood between independent civil servants who are professional scientists, economists, social workers, and the politicos who run the agency. And you want both. You want the political and you want the depth that we talked about before. And you want them to have to kind of work out their compromises in the same way that you hope and that happened in previous eras that Congress and the president work out their differences.
In an online conversation, you referred to privatization as a weapon of the bullies.
Okay.
Who are the bullies?
The political, the agency heads.
Okay, so the
appointees. Well, I'm not exactly sure what the context was for that.
A key weapon of the bullies.
So it's those who want to essentially enact their policies without following the procedural and substantive hurdles that our Congress and the courts have put into place to make sure that government remains limited and non-arbitrary. It's a shortcut. It's a way to essentially push out civil servants or to scare them. Because once privatization is pervasive as it is now, you don't actually have to use it anymore. The weapon exists because if you're a group of civil servants who like your jobs, now you can't get fired because of your job, but your job could disappear if they find contractors to do it in your place. So if I'm a civil servant sitting at my desk, am I going to push back in a world in which privatization is so rampant and non-controversial, or am I going to essentially be that the same compliant actor because I don't want to draw the wrath of a political agency head who is very comfortable and very skilled at privatizing? So I think that's what I meant in that context.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a chilling effect.
Really. Oh, I think it's quite a profound chilling effect. In my book, I refer to Potemkin civil servants who are basically, it says, hey, look, we have this type of meaningful friction between agency heads and civil servants because on paper, they're still classified as civil servants. And on paper, they still have plenty of legal responsibility. But they look around them and everyone else has been out, all their friends' jobs have been outsourced. They're not going to actually play that role of a fierce civil servant. And it's gotten even worse today. So even outside of the privatization, all this rhetoric that they're, you know, they're disloyal, they're deep staters, whatever you want to say about them. You know, Secretary Zinke gave a speech to a business community basically saying that a third of his agency, the Department of Interior, is disloyal to the flag. So there's all sorts of like whistleblowing with the flag saluting. There's all that dog whistling about flags and disloyalty about that. But we haven't seen rhetoric like that since McCarthy. And so again, if you're a civil servant today, you probably, you know, your morale is probably in the gutter. And you know, it's hard, you know, you say, well, why don't they all quit? A lot of them, they're 55 and they have kids in college and they want their pension. It's hard. But we also see people leaving in unprecedented numbers. Mm-hmm. The State Department, and it's places where people have the most marketable skills elsewhere. You'll see that they'll leave first, of course. So to me, it's a problem, and it's getting worse, at least in the short term.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with UCLA law professor John Michaels about the future of the Supreme Court, given Donald Trump's new appointment.
You mentioned earlier Reagan, and I know in your book you also talked about Margaret Thatcher and the phrase she used of nanny state.
Yeah.
And how there was this push to maybe reduce government or make an enemy of government, they calling it the nanny state. But then a move to then put it in the service of something. What is that?
So Reagan ran for office essentially saying he was going to cut Washington down to size. And he was going to strip the EPA of its resources and the Department of Education and all these kind of grand ways of basically making government super duper small. Then he gets to Washington and all these people who said, yeah, great idea – they all kind of wanted to protect their little, basically, pots of services. And so they got a lot of pushback. And Reagan wasn't able to cut the EPA. In fact, spending rose under his administration. Certainly military spending rose, but even domestic spending rose, and employment rose. But he wanted to cut taxes. He did cut taxes. So we have this escalating deficit. Military spending's through the roof. He can't control domestic spending. So folks at various kind of conservative think tanks said, hey, why don't you try this other idea? It's not exactly what they're doing in the United Kingdom. Because in the United Kingdom, the government owned state enterprises. They owned Jaguar. They owned British Petroleum. Those were all state-owned enterprises. We didn't have that. So when they talk about privatization there or privatization in Latin America, it's selling off the telecom companies. We don't have that here. Those were always in private hands. When we privatized here, they said, okay, we're going to cut out civil servants and we're going to hire contractors who are cheaper, don't have benefits, essentially the same casualization of labor we see throughout the economy. At that point, it was largely it was an ideological tool, but it wasn't with a particular political move to change the substance of government. It was a kind of a cost-cutting measure. And then the Clinton-Gore team ran with it. And what I say in the book, in some ways, Reagan is often seen as the kind of critical figure, but in some ways the most important figure is Clinton, because Clinton takes the idea that seemed to be a hard right, ideological, anti-government perspective by Ronald Reagan and mainstreams it and defangs it. So it's no longer this, hostile to Washington. This is all now smarter government, technocratic government. And basically makes it seem palatable to bipartisan audiences. Then they realize this bureaucracy is really stubborn. And we see more as contracting becomes more and more, pushed upwards. So it's no longer low-level jobs, no longer functionary jobs. But now policymakers are being contracted out. This is great because they can kind of match. We can have them follow our orders in a much more, expeditious fashion than civil servants who might say, I see what you're saying there, but that doesn't. Again, I'm just going to say the same thing. But maybe it doesn't support what the law requires. Maybe it's not consistent with best scientific evidence. Maybe it's cutting some procedural corners because civil servants don't work on political timetables. They're not thinking, they shouldn't be thinking about midterm elections. And so they could say, this is actually going to take 2.5 years to be done. And then the politicos say, I know, but we have to run for re-election in 6 months. And that's where these conflicts are produced. And then in the 2000s, it just takes off. And so the debasement and the marginalization of the civil service, again, cuts out this really important set of important legal and political players in our national landscape. And again, you say, ah, civil servants, ah, bureaucrats, well, I don't see they're mentioned in the Constitution. And I get that. But in the 20th century, we have vast delegations of legislative power, which is supposed to be, if you look at the Constitution, done by the legislature. And now all these responsibilities are being delegated to agencies. Agencies become the critical kind of locus of policymaking, not just at the federal level, but you see the same thing at state level, and you see the same thing in any large municipality. Agencies are the main kind of drivers of public policy today. And so we need to think about that space much more carefully than I think we have in the past. And in doing so, it's important to recognize and kind of and credit the role played by the civil servants, that they're not marginal players, they're not illegitimate players. They're meaningful players that have a role, not the dominant role, but a role in the process. And that's why I think if we're going to extend the rule of law to administrative agencies, then we also have to think about what role the civil servants play. And it's much, much bigger than you would understand from reading the Constitution, which doesn't adequately reflect all the dynamics of our current legal political republic.
So from nanny state to sort of nanny corporation.
Yeah.
So you didn't really talk about the corporate side of this so much just now. How would you incorporate that now for us to understand that?
Yeah. So my book is much more about the kind of Republican values and smaller Republican values.
Meaning
commitments to rule of law, commitments to checks and balances.
Like the Republic.
The Republic. The Republic is not a and republicanism is different from kind of direct democracy. Our country has democracy, but it's leavened by some counter-majoritarian checks, the courts being one of the critical ones, being a less than, you know, fully responsive Senate because it only gets elected every 6 years is another one. And to me, the civil service is right up there with it. So the book really is a constitutional argument, and it's a constitutional cultural argument as well. There's a whole other side, which is the kind of corporate kind of coziness and rent seeking and extravagant profits that are essentially secured because there's a lot of money that the federal government has. And when we're in Iraq and Afghanistan and they're throwing the money out, you could be sure that some of the contractors are putting some of it in their back pockets. The reason why the book doesn't focus on that in part is because I think journalists have done such an effective job of detailing it. Now, whether it's moved public policy is a separate question. But to me, that angle of privatization is well documented and well rehearsed. If you watch things like 60 Minutes or you read the New York Times, you have a decent sense that contractors can be really corrupt. What I wanted to do is talk about, hey, even if this corruption were put under wraps, even if we could control the corruption, there's a different problem. And arguably, for my purposes as a constitutional lawyer, a much bigger problem, which is this undermines our rule of law. So that part, the corporate part, is incredibly important, but it's in part it's a story that has been told, and more importantly, it can be a distraction. If all we think about the contractors as being greedy, we forget about how actually compliant they are in order to be so greedy. The best way to be a good contractor is to say yes all the time, so you get more and more contracts. That's the best route to being profitable. Mm.
So the other thing that you suggested was that in the Trump era, there may be finally a pushback because he and his team have been so brazen. So what do you think might happen?
Well, so that's the big question. What would happen? And just as importantly, I think, is when, for those with some impatience about, you know, what's going to happen next, and I share that. The question is essentially what happens, how does the country come back together, and what is the agenda going forward? And I think if we get to that point and there's some kind of catharsis, some kind of, you know, I don't know if it's truth and reconciliation or whether there's prosecutions or we just move on and just kind of forget about it. What is the process in which we kind of shore up the weaknesses in our the vulnerabilities that have been exposed? Again, I think the country's strong. I think we've done in large part a really good job of keeping ourselves together as a nation with an old and very flawed document as our backbone. But there certainly needs to be much more extensive disclosure requirements for financial holdings, much deeper and easier to enforce conflicts of interest laws. And again, I think we need to do much more to shore up to secure a viable, attractive civil service that will get people to go into this job. Which is going to be a hard task itself. You know, why would anyone want to go into the civil service today? I get that from my students all the time. Those are hard questions. They're going to take decades probably to fully kind of right this ship, as it were. Again, that wasn't necessarily what happened after Nixon because everyone closed ranks and we got reforms right afterwards.
Well, we had a divided government too.
We had a
media that was not divided and we had a government that was.
We had a government that was, and we had a Democratic landslide, which helped. But Republicans, I think, were also chagrined at that point. And so they did their job, too. I mean, there were certain things that were, you know, we had congressional overrides of presidential vetoes, which meant you had to have Republican support. We don't get that anymore. So there has to be a political cultural change, a political cultural awakening or recognition before we can get any type of meaningful policy change, because we're going to need to do so through legislation or regulation.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's just been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
John Michaels is a professor of law and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.
I get upset when, even with my own children, I have to remind you, you know, you come from somewhere. You belong to a couple thousand year old family. And it's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
We must admit the past. Only the person who knows her past, his past, can begin to essay where she or he is today and how she or he may begin to chart his tomorrow, her tomorrow.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.